at the meeting of the House Committee on Healthcare for this May 1. Hooray, hooray. It's the 1st of May. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 387A and call David Fredrickson, please. And we'll get Senator Bates to join us when he comes. Can you tell us what this is about?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 387A requires a permit to operate a massage facility, requires the State Board of Massage Therapists to oversee permitting massage facilities, imposes certain other prohibitions on and requirements for massage facilities, and exempts clinic or facility owned or operated by individuals licensed to practice by health professional board. He exempts individual practitioners practicing individual massage therapists and amends specific provisions relating to massage therapy. It becomes operative on January 1st, 2014, and declares emergency effective on its passage.
Thank you.
Good day. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. Thanks. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, and Mr. Thompson, members of the committee, thank you for listening to my testimony today. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 387. I am David Fredrickson. I'm a practicing licensed massage therapist in Oregon since 1987 and a resident of Ashland. I currently serve as the chair of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists and as a policy committee member for the Federation of State Massage Therapy Boards, representing 42 state boards, the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. Senate Bill 387 will provide public health and safety protection by requiring the hiring of state licensed massage therapists by permitted facilities, and two, requiring permitted facilities be subject to sanitation and workplace health and safety laws. The Affordable Health Care Act supports the integration of massage therapy into state-regulated insurance plans, both in its definition of health care practitioners and in its definition of essential health benefits. The Oregon Health Authority will, in all likelihood, adopt similar language to meet AHCA standards, recognizing massage therapy as a safe, proven, cost-effective, complementary, and alternative medical referral option available to physicians and their patients. Under Senate Bill 387, patients benefit by knowing they're receiving health care services from a licensed health professional. Physicians benefit knowing they can refer for licensed massage therapy with the confidence that massage facilities are providing licensed therapeutic massage services. Taxpayers benefit by the assurance their Medicaid dollars are funding legitimate, legal, licensed massage therapy services. The state of Oregon shares the nationwide concern with human trafficking. Representatives, Oregon may have one of the highest per capita rates of sex trafficking. Teens involved in sex trafficking and sex for sale establishments in the nation. The historic overlap with illicit massage facilities offering sexual services is clear to everyone. Current Oregon law is focused on penalizing sex industry workers providing massage services, in effect criminalizing the victims of sex trafficking whose lives and livelihoods are being controlled, threatened, and abused. Investigation and prosecution of human traffickers themselves often involves the coordinated efforts of federal and state law enforcement agencies due to the interstate nature of their illicit business. This is an expensive, protracted process, often outside of the means and priorities of state and local law enforcement personnel. Senate Bill 387 provides a simple, cost-effective regulatory mechanism to access and limit facilities involved with sex trafficking under the guise of massage therapy by, one, requiring a one-time purchase of a massage facility's permit, two, requiring the hiring of licensed massage therapists, and three, requiring compliance with state sanitation and workplace health and safety law. Senate Bill 387 has the unanimous support of the Oregon State Senate and the major massage industry trade organizations, the American Massage Therapy Association, the Association for Bodywork and Massage Professionals, and the Federation of State Massage Therapy Boards. Also, the CHP group representing the chiropractic profession in Oregon, Oregon Massage School Owners, Massage Educators, Massage Business Owners, the Child Abuse Support Network of Jackson County, social service and interfaith groups supporting victims of human trafficking, healthcare professionals counseling trauma victims, and licensed massage therapists and their clients. It is to this end, representatives, that I ask you, please, to protect the health and safety of Oregonians by supporting Senate Bill 387 and move it forward to the House of Representatives for consideration. And I invite your questions.
Thank you. Senator? Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator from Southern Oregon. I was very happy to be the chief sponsor of this bill. Would welcome any belts wanting to be chief co-sponsor with me or to sign on the bill. This bill actually started from a trip to the Trinity Alps in Northern California that didn't go too well, and it was his fault.
Yeah.
Okay. He went down the mountain too fast. We lost one of our partners, had to go back up and down, back and forth, and from that grew a friendship that he started talking to me about the issues of massage therapy and the difficulty and for me, the shock that massage therapy in the Medford area and across the state was actually being used as a shield for prostitution. And, you know, we've seen massage parlors and kind of do some things went on, but we always thought that was sort of, well, we have to put up with this. But it has grown to a level that I think is really dangerous from bringing women in from overseas in virtual bondage. And this bill goes a long ways to dealing with that issue. We have other bills in the Senate and the House that are also dealing with it, but it's a very serious issue. And it took me a while to understand what was going on in my own community in Medford and how we'd all turn a blind eye to it. So that's one part of this bill to me that's very important. The other half of the bill that's important to me is as a physician, I've learned to rely on legitimate massage therapy to help my patients over and over again. I use chiropractors, I use massage therapists, I use naturopaths in my practice. They all have something to help on these issues. And even in an era where it's hard to get massage therapy covered sometimes by insurance, especially in cases where I think they do an exemplary job and do a job that nobody else can do, this is the kind of bill we need to get passed to help that move forward. We're going to see, I believe, massage therapy become a fully recognized profession that it really is, and these kind of bills help us do that and separate it from this other horrible thing that goes on behind closed doors and gives massage therapy, frankly, a black eye. So I'm hoping you'll vote a yes on this. If I remember right, it came out of committee with no votes, and the same on the floor with the Senate. And I'm sure Dave has done a great job in explaining the bill to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Are there questions in this panel?
Questions?
Which is the only panel in this bill.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit more about what's the educational requirements to get a massage therapy license, what's the fee, and what are the requirements in the fee for a facility license as well?
The facilities license as proposed in the bill is a one-time fee of $50
mm-hmm.
per brick-and-mortar facility.
When someone comes in and does a inspection, I'm assuming?
Someone would be able to come in and inspect for a permit. I'm sure a process would be involved to allow adequate amount of time to obtain said permit. Once a facility has the permit, they will then be required to hire state licensed therapists. There is no such legal provision thus far. Facilities can hire unlicensed massage professionals, and the onus of responsibility is on the persons providing the massage services, not on the person hiring them. And this is the issue in terms of the trafficking that goes on in the state. In the state of Oregon, licensed massage therapists must attend 500 hours minimum training. Most of the quality programs in the state far exceed that, anywhere from 650 to 1,000 hours of instruction provided. That qualifies individuals to sit for the state board exams and the national certification exams to be licensed to practice massage in the state of Oregon. Unfortunately, in this business, we in Oregon are... We share concerns with everyone along the I-5 corridor in recognizing that we have persons largely of color and largely women being trafficked in massage facilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate. We have investigations proceeding in every major municipality along the I-5 corridor in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
both federal and state, in order to identify human traffickers and their victims.
Mm-hmm.
There are social service and interfaith programs set up in every major municipality to help the victims of this heinous process.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ask about cost?
Yeah, cost for the massage therapy license.
The cost for the license, I'm going to have to defer to staff in the room. The actual education depends on the institution that a person chooses to go through.
For
just
at
a
least
moment.
500 hours.
Yeah.
One follow-up?
Sure.
Are there other states that you fashion this legislation on? Other states taking the same approach?
There are, I believe, three other states that currently have massage permitting bills or massage permitting process. I believe it's Florida and Michigan being two of them.
Representative Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer. For the record, my name is Kate Coffey. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Massage. The cost to obtain an initial license, are you talking the cost for the license or the cost for the education?
Both would be interesting.
Okay, the cost for the education depends upon which school they attend, and it is my understanding that it's anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000 for the education, and it costs approximately $350 for a massage license.
On an annual basis?
No, that's for the initial license.
Initial.
The renewals are $150 for a biennium.
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Just a clarification. What's the hammer in this bill? If I'm a consumer and walking down the street and I see a massage parlor, is this going to require some notation on the front door that it's certified? How, as a consumer, will I know that such a certification even exists? And secondly, does this allow the police then to raid unlicensed ones? Or how do we get at the problem? I see where we set aside a legitimate group. What do we do about the illegitimate side? How does this dovetail?
This is a bill that I believe is largely focused on the illegitimate side. Legitimate massage facilities and business owners have nothing to fear from this legislation. This would allow the regulators in the state and law enforcement access to facilities with substantial civil penalties and potential cease and desist orders.
But we really could get at it then.
Positively.
Yeah.
It's a term protection bill as well, isn't it? It protects the use of massage.
Pardon me? Please.
I was looking at the bill. There's a section of the bill that protects the term massage or massage therapy.
The term massage is codified currently, and it is protected by law. If a person uses the term massage in advertising and practice in an unlicensed manner, they are subject to civil penalty currently.
Yeah. Representative Clem, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand it. So the owner of the facility, if they're not performing massages, doesn't have to be an LMT. They just need to get one of these new facility licenses.
The owner of the facility, providing they are not already a state licensed health professional, would be subject to the permitting fee. State licensed health professionals who are governed by health boards are exempt.
Yeah, I just want to make sure somebody who owns the business but just hires licensed people can still do that as long as they get this, but they don't have to become an LMT just to own the business.
No, they do not.
That's all I was really interested in.
No, they do not.
And if, follow up, how is it again that I thought everybody in Oregon had to have a license to give a massage already, but you said
no, sir.
It's not the case.
No, in Oregon, as in many places on the West Coast, you have a variety of professional services being performed under the guise of massage, some legal and some illicit.
And there's, why do people get a license then anyway, currently?
To comply with the law, sir.
No, because of, up till now they don't. You can open up a massage parlor and do what you want.
For example, I was...
Well, it's not the law yet, so they're not getting them currently to comply with the law. They're getting them for other reasons.
If a person, say myself, I moved to Oregon and obtained a licensure here because the state was as well regulated as it was, and massage was becoming an integrated part of the allied healthcare community. So it was in my personal interest to be affiliated with the healthcare community of this state.
But it's all voluntary right now? You don't have to become an LMT to...
In the state of Oregon, the way the law exists is if you advertise for massage and perform massage services without licensure, you are subject to civil penalty.
Current law?
Current.
Okay, that's what I would...
Yes.
I thought you just said it.
Oh, no. No, the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists has the authority, full rulemaking authority and compliance oversight of our scope of practice, equivalent to other health care providers in this state.
Wait, hold on a minute.
I'm confused.
Now, if you're...
I'm even more confused.
If I go out and open a store and get five captured women to be masseuses, I can do that.
Yes, sir, you can.
With this bill, I can't do that, right?
No, sir, you couldn't.
It's a change in the law to require if I'm going to open up a store that says massage, I now have to get a permit to do it.
That part I got, but the masseuses already under current law also would have been in trouble for not having a license.
Only
current
if they,
law.
Only if they define themselves as massage therapists.
Yes.
If they're advertising well.
The distinction being that those providing the services are subject to the legal penalties, those trafficking them or hiring them are not currently.
So, you're not helping this.
I'm on a new topic. New topic.
Senator Bates, can you help us on this a little?
I think the way I understand it is, and what commonly happens is, Dave is, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is that you'll have individuals who have multiple sites up and down the West Coast, and then they bring these women in and advertise as not massage therapists, maybe massage. And these women are essentially in bondage for prostitution, and we can't get to them.
That's okay. Not the instance I'm thinking of. Okay. I'm wondering about people who, like I have two friends in Hood River, they operate a daycare. They went and got trained in Hawaii for Lomi Lomi Massage.
Right.
It's not a licensed facility now because that's not what they do for money and they don't advertise it. But, you know, my mother-in-law will go down there and she'll get a massage. These are, you know, family friends. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of people like them. If they ever wanted to turn it into a business, under this, they just got to pay $50 and get the facility licensed, which is not a big deal. And then current law is that they, if they were going to be advertising their services and not just giving friends the Hawaiian-style massage that they are experts in, they would already have to have gotten their LMT.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can I ask one follow-up question to that? So currently, it's illegal to advertise as a massage therapist, but it's not illegal to perform it?
Currently, it is illegal to massage, to advertise for massage services and perform massage services if you are not licensed in the state.
Okay.
Advertise and perform.
One or the other, or both.
Either.
You can't. Okay. You can't give a massage without a license. Just,
money,
you know, to your family members.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, there are people that do this all the time. I don't mean to confuse the issue for you. There are persons that obtain training and exchange massages with their family and friends.
Yeah.
We're not trying to interfere with their lives.
Okay,
no.
That's what I was going.
I'm going to close this before we get deeper into the woods.
Can I just say
read the bill carefully before we work it, and if you need any help, call on our witness.
Yeah.
Well, not on Senator Bates. You don't need to bother.
One last comment. I really want to thank Dave Fredericks for his leadership on this. He has taken a real social issue for us that directly affected him and our community and really carried the ball on this. My name may be on the bill. It should be his bill. He's done a great job in this. It's taken a year and a half, 2 years, huge amount of his time driving all over the state to do this. And I really appreciate the work he's done, not only for our community, but for those women coming from overseas that are, frankly, being abused.
Yeah, if I can add to this, there was an institution, if I remember correctly, right near Representative Harker's office at one time that was obviously a prostitution shop. And there was no way that the city could get to it. I mean, there was no way the county could get to it. There was no way to get in there. I don't think it was a part of Representative Harker's business, but it was.
You're not sure.
It was within a couple hundred yards. You could never tell. You want to defend yourself on this one?
I'm not going anywhere near this.
I think this is a very important bill, and I think forcing these people in the permit, getting the access to inspect them, dealing with sanitation, which clearly I understand in this place was abysmal. I can't tell you for sure. I have not good authority.
I suspect this with many bills.
I'm going to get in with Harker if I'm not careful. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
I suspect this with many bills, if we reread it, we'll answer our own questions and probably created our own confusion here today.
Yeah.
Good chance. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 387 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 420. You want to tell us about that one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 420A requires facility performing mammogram to notify patients of results and possible increased risk of breast cancer to advise patients to contact their health care provider regarding appropriateness of supplemental testing if mammogram indicates dense breast tissue. Prohibits cost sharing for mammograms and breast ultrasounds meeting specified criteria. It defines dense breast tissue and declares emergency effective on its passage.
We have some of our colleagues here, Representative Whitman, Senator Dingfelder. There you are. I was looking for you. Good.
$50.
Steiner Hywood, Hayward, go for it. In any order.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yesterday was Senator Steiner Hayward Day.
Spillover.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You get two free knives if you can.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share our testimony on Senate Bill 420. For the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder, State Senator for District 23, that's Northeast, Southeast, Portland, and Maywood Park. According to the Center for Disease Control, breast cancer is a leading cause of cancer-related deaths among women. And I'm sure you're aware that it kills many women, but it kills over 40,000 women. That was in 2009 alone. The good news is that the use of mammography, we are able to catch cancer earlier when it's more treatable, and that's what this bill is all about. However, mammography is less effective at catching cancer in women with dense breast tissue. For some of you, you may not know what that is, so let me explain. Dense breast tissue is comprised of less fatty tissue and more glandular tissue. What this means is that on a mammogram, dense breast tissue appears as white, the same color as tumors, making it very difficult to detect early stages of cancer. In fact, mammograms typically miss 40% or more of tumors in women with dense breast tissue, and you're going to hear some personal stories today after our panel. In addition to masking cancers, dense breast tissue is an independent risk factor and can be a greater risk factor than having two first-degree relatives with breast cancer. Yet very few women know the risks associated with dense breast tissue, let alone their own density. So what this bill does is it seeks to raise awareness and educate women about dense breast tissue. Senate Bill 420 would require a healthcare facility that performs a mammogram noting dense breast tissue to issue a notice to the patient, educating them about dense breast tissue and the risks associated with this issue. This will allow women to better understand the risks that they face of getting breast cancer and to understand the limits of mammography. It will also prevent more stories like you will hear from a witness today, from Ms. Caldwell, who thought she was doing everything that she needed to, and still the doctors missed her cancer for 2 years. So the bill that's before you today is a bipartisan bill. It came over with unanimous support from the state Senate, and we urge your support as it will save lives by educating women about the risks of dense breast tissue and make them more aware of alternatives to mammography. So I think I'll pass this off to my colleague and co-sponsor from the House, and then my other colleague, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Thompson and Kenny Geyer, and committee members. I'm Representative Gail Whitsitt, and I am from House District 56, which is the southern half of Klamath and Lake Counties along the California border. My staff of Kelsey Ferry and Sarah Dressler worked on a nearly identical House bill 2015 with me this session. The concept for the mammogram bill, as it became known in our office, was begun by, and a great deal of work was done by, Judy Trago, Senator Whitsitt's Chief of Staff. We're very pleased to support Senate Bill 420 as it is passed from the Senate, as it incorporates the very same issues as our House bill. We have prepared for the committee handouts which emphasize the important issues regarding this bill. As you may know, breast cancer is the most common female malignancy and the second leading cause of cancer-related death in females in the United States. It is my hope that Senate Bill 420 will help increase survival rates, decrease medical costs, and reduce the number of women who must endure the agony of learning they have breast cancer after being told by their doctor that their mammogram showed no negative results or that it showed negative results. I respectfully urge your aye vote on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Thompson, Vice Chair Kenninger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. I'm the state senator from District 17, Northwest Portland, unincorporated Multnomah and Washington counties, Loretta Beaverton, which I share with two wonderful members of this committee, Representative Harker and Representative Greenlick. In my other life, I'm a family physician at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm also the director of the Breast Health Education Program in the Knight Cancer Institute at OHSU. I've been working on improving early detection of breast cancer in Oregon since about 2000, so pretty long time in the traces on this one. I've been mostly focused on clinical breast exams, the exams that healthcare providers do for women and men when there's a concern about a breast lump or as a screening procedure. But one of the things I've learned in the process of doing that is that mammograms aren't perfect. We have a lot of faith in technology, and some of it is well-placed and some of it not so much. I don't want anybody to take my testimony here to say that people shouldn't get mammograms as part of their breast cancer screening. I just want people to understand that, as my colleagues have pointed out, physicians and patients are inappropriately reassured by quote-unquote normal mammograms. And there are other modalities that are important for screening, especially for women with dense breast tissue, where it can be very hard to distinguish, as Senator Dingfelder pointed out, to distinguish between normal and abnormal tissue because of the ways that the x-rays pass or don't pass through the tissue. This is about patient empowerment. This is about helping our patients be active partners in their own health care. It's about educating them. It's about making sure that people make informed choices about breast cancer screening. And it's an opportunity to help people think about other options for screening and to choose those options in cooperation with their primary care provider. I think it's an important bill. I'm delighted to be co-chief sponsoring it with Representative Woodsit and Senator Dingfelder. Everybody's put in a lot of hard work on this, and you'll be hearing, as several people have mentioned, from citizens of this state who've been adversely affected by this problem, whom with any luck, passage of this bill will help prevent some other women from going through what Ms. Caldwell and others have experienced. Thank you, and I urge your aye vote.
Purpose of the bill would be to have whoever sending out breast cancer results for the woman with dense breast tissue to add a warning to that information. The warning is in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you'd like, somebody could read that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It might be.
Just to be clear, if I may, Mr. Chair, every mammography facility to be licensed as a mammography facility, part of the rules are that they have to send result letters directly to patients. And those letters are fairly standard. They're pre-printed, essentially, except they add the patient's name and they CC her primary care provider. So we're not asking for a lot. We're asking simply that some standard language be added for women who have dense breast tissue saying, you have this. We know that this can be an increased risk for breast cancer. It can also make your mammogram harder to read, and we encourage you to discuss this with your primary care provider so that you can make thoughtful decisions about other forms of breast cancer screening that might be appropriate for you. Not telling her what to do, not trying to scare anybody, but just making sure that they understand the implications of their particular physical construction.
Thank you. Are there any questions, panel? Representative Thompson?
If I'm reading this right, if that information is sent to physicians now and it's not being acted on, is that a reason to have increased physician education also?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, the information is being sent to physicians in a sometimes less than constructive way, I must say, with all due respect to my radiology colleagues. Speaking as one of the physicians, my physician hat on, having received these reports, what it'll say is, breast tissue is dense, makes it a little bit harder to read, clinical correlation suggested, or words to that effect. And physicians do know that, I would say the majority of physicians do know that breast density can be a contributing risk factor for breast cancer. They do know that it makes mammograms harder to read. But I've got to be honest with you, physicians have been a little bit suckered by the mammography propaganda, if you will. It sounds a little bit strong, but I mean it.
Yeah.
We all have. Mammography is a hugely important piece of breast cancer screening, but it's not the be-all and end-all, especially for women with dense breast tissue.
It sounds to me like it might be a larger problem. I approve the bill, but you know, if the information is given to physicians, I kind of look at them as a first line of defense, even though there's personal responsibility involved. And if they're not following through, that's another issue that on top of this one.
Yes, okay. I would agree with that, sir.
Is that counter?
You took my question.
Yes.
Kind of a follow-up to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. So I noticed in the summary here that the insurance mandate has been taken out, and I'm curious, since you've been digging into this issue, how often are women who have to take that secondary test covered by insurance, and what are some of the follow-up steps that we can do once they're aware of this information?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, this is a big challenge, and here's the challenge. Many of you have heard me speak before about the importance of evidence-based practice in healthcare. We really don't have great evidence about exactly what the right screening is, the additional screening is for women with dense breast tissue. Mm-hmm. There are no really good studies to say, well, ultrasound is clearly the right answer, or diagnostic mammograms as opposed to screening mammograms, or MRIs, or pick your imaging modality of choice. Because of that, we were willing to drop the insurance mandate in this iteration of the bill. We still have concerns. Anecdotally, we hear about women who have dense breast tissue where there's something questionable on their mammogram, and it's recommended they have the ultrasound, and then all of a sudden it turns into a diagnostic procedure. I should point out, if I may, for the committee, that screening procedures, health prevention procedures such as mammography, are considered standard procedures and are generally 100% covered under health insurance. The state has a mandate about that. That was reinforced by the Affordable Care Act. But once a procedure translates, and a screening mammogram just involves two views of the breast, two different angles, a diagnostic mammogram or a diagnostic ultrasound as opposed to a screening test, when you think there might be something there and you're trying to figure it out, all of a sudden falls under a totally different set of insurance characteristics, at which point there can be copays or deductibles or whatever involved, which is what adds to the expense, and that's where our concern lay. I think the conversation we need to be having with the insurance industry is about whether we can get them to classify these supplemental tests for these women as screening, part of a screening mammogram, which I would really like to start calling breast cancer screening imaging, right, as opposed to just a mammogram, because that would be a little bit more inclusive. But that's going to take some conversations, and I respect the challenges that the insurance industry is facing right now, and I want to work collaboratively with them, I think we all do, to try to figure out a thoughtful way to approach this problem. You may well see us again in 2014 having had some conversations and figured out a way to address this problem. We don't have great evidence. I wish we did, but we don't.
Okay, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the
bill.
Thank you.
And I apologize.
It's an important
bill. We've got work session next door, so I'm going to have to.
We'll call you if we need you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can we call, go ahead.
Laura Caldwell, Lynn Swinney.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Laura Caldwell, and I live in Eugene. Thank you for allowing me a few minutes of your time today. I was able and honored to share my story back in February with the Senate Committee on this, and I am honored again to be here to share my story in support of Senate Bill 420. I'm the mother of three children and have been happily married for 26 years. In August of 2011, I had my annual mammogram, as I had had the previous 6 years. The mammogram came back clear and fine, as it had the previous 6 years. And I had no history of breast cancer in my family, so this was not a screening test that I was ever worried about. And I worked really hard to reduce the risk factors in my life. A month later, after several days of some pain under my left arm, I went to the doctor, and she put me on a course of antibiotics, noting that I'd had a clear mammogram. She said, if it's not better in 10 days, come back. 10 days later, I was back for an ultrasound. And she, again, noting my clear mammogram, just to be safe. My ultrasound revealed a lump and the biopsy the next day confirmed invasive ductal carcinoma that had spread to my lymph nodes. When the diagnosing doctor called me to tell me the news, I asked him why the mammogram hadn't caught my tumor. He said it was because I had what was called dense breast tissue, and that the tumors don't show up easily on mammograms of women with dense breast tissue. In fact, he said, he was looking again at my now eight-week-old mammogram, and he still could not see the tumor on the scan, even though the biopsy and pathology reports confirmed the cancer. When I questioned the doctor further, I said, "No one has ever told me I have dense breast tissue." And he said, and I'll quote him, "We don't usually tell women that information." I would later find out that my tumor was 2 years old by the time we discovered it. It could have gone undetected even longer if I had not developed symptoms. And in essence, I had had two, maybe three mammograms, all while living with the growing cancer. Despite the fact that 40% of women have dense breast tissue, and women with it are 4 to 6 times more likely to get breast cancer, fewer than 10% of women with dense tissue are told by their physicians. As you can see from my own experience, I only found out about my dense tissue and ultimately my cancer from that supplemental screening. Having dense breast tissue is a risk factor. There's no history of breast cancer in my family, but breast density is a more significant risk factor for developing breast cancer than having a first-degree relative with it. My work as a consultant and trainer with the Pampered Chef puts me in front of hundreds of women every year, and I've discovered as I've shared my story with them that the majority of these women have never heard the term dense breast tissue, let alone if they have it or that it's a risk factor. We all know that early detection is the best possible way to treat breast cancer, but women are not hearing about their breast density from their doctors. And of course, that's making it harder to catch these cancers early. My cancer, as you heard the senator say, as with all cancers, show up as white on a mammogram. Unfortunately, dense tissue also shows up as white on the scan, hiding many cancers from being seen. Women should be receiving this information in their doctor's office, not after they've already developed breast cancer. Originally, my cancer diagnosis classified my cancer at stage 3. My cancer was not detected early because of the failure of mammography technology to detect cancer in my dense tissue. I'm encouraged by this bill that would notify more women and more women earlier. Oregon has one of the highest rates of breast cancer in the country, although one of the lowest death rates. This could shift dramatically in either direction depending upon the outcome of this bill. So in 2012, I completed 4 months of chemotherapy, a bilateral mastectomy with lymphectomy, and 7 weeks of daily radiation. I went into remission a year ago, March. In February of this year, so just a few months ago, my breast cancer was discovered to have spread to a tumor in my brain, reclassifying my cancer as stage 4. Just 9 weeks ago, I had surgery to remove it, just a week after my Senate committee testimony, and have since also completed 5 days of treatment, a radiation treatment at OHSU. I do believe that if I had caught my cancer earlier, I would have a different story to tell you. There are 6 states in our country that require doctors to tell women about their breast tissue, and I implore you to make Oregon the 7th. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing your story.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlick and other committee members. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Lynn Sweeney. I live in Southeast Portland. This bill is very important to me because my sister-in-law, Laura Caldwell, is currently being treated for cancer that began in her dense breast tissue. She was unaware she had dense breasts until her diagnosis. I'm so torn up that she's going through this, and I don't want to lose her. I feel so helpless because there is nothing I can do directly to affect her health. She is so dear to our family. The only way I can help is to urge you to move forward with this bill. Then maybe other women will have their cancer detected during routine testing. My sister-in-law didn't get that chance. And I hate to say this, she may die because of it. Here are some facts about dense breast tissue and cancer. Breast density is a well-established predictor of breast cancer. In dense breasts, mammograms missed half of the cancers. And 40% of women have dense breast tissue. Adding other technologies, such as ultrasound, can increase detection by up to 100%. Therefore, knowing if you have dense breasts is vital to making informed decisions about your health. Now, there is no requirement to even tell women. Here's another sobering fact. 95% of women do not know their breast density. I'm very surprised health care providers don't routinely provide this information to women. Is it because providers fear increased cost of testing, or perhaps they don't think women need to know? Either reason is completely indefensible. I strongly urge you to move forward through this bill. Oregon women need this. In closing, I would ask you, Representative Kenny Geyer, do you know if you have dense breasts? Men, do you know if your significant others have dense breasts? Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry.
Yes.
I would think, and this is not a subject that I have a great deal of knowledge in, obviously. I would think this 40% number should be a whole lot more important than it apparently is. And with this kind of disease state, it seems to me it would not be unreasonable for women determined to have dense breast tissue to be automatically shuttled off into another treatment mode. If we're talking about real diagnostic credibility, it's almost unbelievable that the number 40%, as big as it is, would just elicit a, oh, what the heck, and go on. If they have a higher likelihood of cancer and the number is that big, we've dropped the ball badly.
It seems
to me like this. I approve this bill, but I think we haven't gone far enough. I mean, we ought to look at
the initial bill as it was written included offering additional testing for women with dense breasts. However, it's my understanding that one of the reasons that this was dropped was because of the fiscal impacts, and that finding out what the fiscal impacts would be would dramatically reduce the chance of passing this portion in this term.
And this is the insanity we deal with on a daily basis. Do you have any idea what the fiscal impact of breast cancer on a woman is? Well, you do.
I do.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you talk about fiscal impact compared to what? And I think insurance company would take a look at that and go, as a risk analysis.
I think Dr. Steiner Hayward's point was that we don't precisely know exactly what to do, which is partly because we haven't really been dealing with this issue.
I would hope we don't pass this bill and forget about it. I'll put it that way.
Thank you. I don't either. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Anybody else?
I just wanted to thank you for sharing your story.
Yes. You're welcome.
This month marked 16 years ago that my first wife died of complications from breast cancer. It was interesting because she had regular mammograms and things as similar to yours were pretty far along by the time they really figured out there was a problem. And it makes you wonder what in the world was going on. Fortunately, they made gigantic progress in treatments, and I think if she were diagnosed today, she'd be very likely to survive.
A different story.
I wish you well.
Thank you very much.
This is the 50th anniversary of my mother's death from breast cancer, so it's been very much on my mind this year.
Thank you.
I just wanted to thank you, too. I saw you at the press conference right before your operation, and you brought me to tears at that point. I have one of my best friends was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer second day of the legislature last year. So that was right at the beginning of my legislative term. And then the second or third week this year, it was discovered that it had gone to her liver and bones. We're the guardians of her children. This has really hit very close to home for me. And you know, I don't even know if she has, she's a women's health nurse. I don't know if she has breast sense tissue. So obviously we need a lot more awareness about
Everyone's
it.
Everyone's been impacted by it.
Yeah. So thank you for helping bring awareness to this, and I do hope we go further.
Thank you.
I'm sure we'll go further. I close the public hearing on House Bill 4020 and open a public hearing on House Bill 167A. Will you tell us what this bill is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 167A grants authority to the public health director to authorize licensed pharmacists to administer vaccines to persons 3 years of age or older in declared emergency or disease outbreak.
Could you please call the witnesses?
Bill Cross and Signia Vernon.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. And we are here to support Senate Bill 167-A, a bill that would allow the public health director or governor to permit pharmacists to vaccinate children between the ages of 3 and 10 in health emergencies. Currently, pharmacists are able to vaccinate children down to the age of 11. Unless they have a prescription, then they can vaccinate children the ages of 3 and older. Well, actually, any age, except the training is basically from the ages of 3 and over. So we've got trained pharmacists that are out there available, and this would allow, under certain health emergencies, the governor or the health director to include them in any vaccination programs that they might want to initiate. I'd be happy to answer questions, but I've brought a pharmacist with me who does a lot of training to help explain the kind of training that the pharmacists do have in vaccinations. Her name is Signia Bernholm with Fred Meyer.
Mr. Chair and fellow representatives, my name is Signia Bernholm. I am a pharmacist, and I'm the clinical coordinator for Fred Meyer. I'm here to in support of the bill, and I'd like to tell you a bit about our educational procedures that we go through in training our pharmacists and future pharmacists. So this is a national standardized program that is peer-reviewed. It contains a didactic portion, video portion, and hands-on skills. It's reviewed often to update with new products, new procedures, and new information that comes out all the time. It consists of 12 hours of home study by each of the students, which is followed by a post-test. Then there is a live portion, a class, that is held where we go over all the parameters that they learned in the self-study, which includes history of vaccines, relevant problems that we've had with them, adverse reactions, how they work, a lot of different things that way. There's also a hands-on portion. In the hands-on portion, the trainer will observe the students giving a minimum of 2 IM injections with normal saline to each other and make sure that they're using correct technique, 1 subcutaneous shot also. And then I, in my program, also train on the intradermal and the intranasal. I'm just here to help you with any questions you might have. So thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Thompson?
Could you put on the record what that training consists of relative to adverse reactions?
I'm sorry. So the adverse reactions would contain both per the common adverse reactions for each of the vaccinations, plus emergency adverse reactions. We are also trained in emergency procedures, and we have an e-kit all
the
time.
What I was getting at.
Yes, yes. And we also train, I like to train them on the use of the device, in this case possibly EpiPen or the Benadryl.
I've heard pushback in the past about pharmacists and immunizations that they're not trained in emergency procedures, which is patently untrue, but I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you.
Could you tell me what sort of a public health emergency you could imagine that this would kick into?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the emergency could be an earthquake that would require tetanus shots. It could be a flu emergency, like we just experienced this last year. State of Washington declared, and some other states, I believe, declared, you know, emergency flu vaccinations because of that. Looking out at the weather today, it's hard to believe, but I'm sure there are other, you know, kinds of emergencies. But those would be the ones, I think, that were contemplated when we looked at developing the bill.
Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Two questions. One is, why set the floor at 3? If there's a really an emergency outbreak, why not be able to do babies? And second question is, are there other states that do this as well?
So to the answer to the question, why 3? That is where our training limitations are at this time. If there was more training developed in it further by, like, this national certification board, then we possibly could do that. But right now, that's where our limitations are. Do other states do this? Bill, was it other states?
Other states?
There are other states. However, please do not ask me to name them. I'm looking behind.
I would suggest Texas. You might want to use Texas.
Excellent.
I was going to suggest Texas.
Quick pickup. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I believe Texas has no limit on age at this time, and this has been several years ago when we were talking about pharmacy immunizations in Oregon. At that time, they had no record of complaints.
All sorts of weird things happened in Texas.
Yeah, I know, but it seemed to be working really well in Texas for a period of time. And although they did have the opportunity now to elect not to do infants if they didn't want the training.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 167A and open a public hearing on SCR 6. And call the first panel. Do we have Diane Sandler, Ron Steiner, Kara Pierce, and if Representative Williamson wanders in, we'll have her join the panel. Well, we have one. They do. They all have to be licensed now. Now they want to get into business. Did you lose?
My first one. It's just more fee and more regulations when they are.
On Steiner here? Oh, there you are.
Okay. Let me understand what they're talking about.
Okay, go for it.
I can't find an incidence of it in Oregon. Before someone got busted.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Diane Representative Greenlick, Chairman of the House Health Care Committee, and members of the committee. I am thrilled to be here today. I have the honor of testifying on behalf of Dr. William Connor's history and his accomplishments, both as an individual and as his colleague at Oregon State or Oregon Health Sciences University. My name is Diane Stadler. I am an assistant professor of medicine at OHSU. I am a clinical researcher and had worked with Dr. Connor for about 8 years prior to his death. And I'm also the director of the graduate programs in human nutrition at OHSU. I'm here to thank you for considering this resolution and to recognize Senator Shields in his putting this resolution forward to honor the works of Dr. Connor. He was truly an incredible clinician. He was respected and revered by his patients, as well as the number of clinical faculty that he mentored throughout a number of years in healthcare practice and in clinical research. For the 8 years prior to his death, he and I and a colleague at the Kaiser Center for Health Research, Jerry Karanja, submitted and received 3 NIH-funded grants to look at the impact of diet and different types of diet on various health parameters. And we were very successful at carrying out these projects in the greater Portland area, as well as Oregon itself. And we continue to work on these projects. As a young researcher at OHSU, I had the privilege of working with Dr. Connor. He was a mentor. I saw him both as a mentor for my clinical research path as well as my healthcare path. He and I worked together with patients that had very rare diseases, and the conditions usually were found in very young children, and they were not curable conditions. And he and I and other members of the OHSU staff carried out clinical trials on these very young children and invited their families to OHSU for these trials. He also was a significant teacher. He was a teacher for our dietetics students, medical students, the physician assistance program. Every component of healthcare he touched as an investigator and a clinical scientist and a promoter of strong evidence-based healthcare for individuals across the age spectrum. Individually, I want to recognize his support of my career as well as a support of other people's careers. He was never short on advice, and usually that advice was offered when it was asked for, not just given as a means of demonstrating his experience. He was always present. He was available. He brought to people's attention opportunities that they could take advantage of that they may not have known had he not brought those opportunities to their attention. And that could have been research grant opportunities. It could have been support for tuition reimbursement. It could have been opportunities to gain clinical research or clinical experience beyond the experience that the individual had. He was always available. And then finally, I want to bring to light on a personal basis, again, his availability and his willingness to talk with anybody that approached him about questions about healthcare. For me personally, that came as an opportunity for him to become involved in my father's healthcare. My father had a rare aneurysm, aortic aneurysm at the aortic arch placement, and he was going to have surgery to repair that aneurysm. And the surgery was going to be done at Johns Hopkins by a surgeon named Duke Cameron. And my father, being a great Duke supporter, said, "How else can I? Who else could I trust more than somebody named Duke Cameron?" Duke being one of his universities that he graduated with, but Cameron being significant because Cameron Indoor Stadium is the basketball arena for the Duke team. So he's very confident in this individual. Well, this surgeon called our house. I had flown back to the Washington, D.C. area, and he called our house at about 11:30 at night, said, "I have a significant question that I have to ask you," and we were still awake because I had just arrived. And he said, "You know, we're going to be doing the surgery, and we are going to also be exploring other potential opportunities to repair any complications that you might have, one being a potential valve replacement." And he said, "I need to know if we have to do this valve replacement, if you want a pig valve or if you want a synthetic valve." My father's on the phone with this person. He has no medical background. It's 11:30 at night. He doesn't have access to any other type of resources. So I said, "Give me a few minutes. I'll make a few phone calls." And I called Dr. Connor at home. And I said, and nobody knew where I was or what I was doing, and I explained the situation to him. And it was relatively late in Oregon at that time. And he gave me his opinion, and he said, "At this point in time, I'd go with the pig valve. This is what I would do, and this is why I'd do it, and these are the questions that you need to call back and ask your surgeon." And he was right there at the moment that I needed him to be able to answer those questions, because my father's surgery was going to start at 5:30 the next morning. And we had no other source of information. That's one example of many examples of people needing his expertise, appreciating his expertise, and him offering it without hesitation. There are many other opportunities that I could share with you, but as a representative of both OHSU and personally, I want to strongly encourage you to consider this resolution and really allow us to recognize his accomplishments, both as an individual, as a healthcare provider, and as an incredibly strong citizen of the Portland area, as well as the greater Oregon area, for all the work that he has done, both as a healthcare provider and as a very active citizen of our community. Thank you.
Thank you.
I thought the senator.
My accolade.
Thank you, Ron, for letting me go first. I do need to get back to another engagement, but
I'm going to take your chair to testify when you're done.
Say again.
I say I'm going to take your chair to testify.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, District 22. I was pleased to be involved in the development of this resolution on the Senate side. I got to know Bill Connor over the years as an activist, primarily, and Bill was a very humble man, And in fact, when I was preparing my floor speech, I asked my wife, what would you say about Bill Connor? And she got to know him quite well through her activism as well. And she said he was such a kind, loving, humble man. And she told me about the time when she was a massage therapist thinking about going to medical school, thinking about going to nursing school. And she sat down. She asked Bill if he would write a letter of recommendation for her to medical school and or nursing school. I said, well, no, I can't write a letter of recommendation for you. We need to, without having a conversation and figuring out what makes you tick, what kind of medicine you want to practice. They've known each other a long time, but he said, why don't you come over to the house? They had a cup of tea, cup of coffee, and for 45 minutes, you know, he asked her questions about why she wanted to get into medicine. And, you know, when she talked about being involved in holistic care and all of those kinds of things, he said, you know, you really should go to nursing school. I think it'd be a much better fit. Mm-hmm. And that's coming from a physician. And I think that says a lot about who Bill was, you know, always trying to put himself in the other person's shoes. And I think as a person, he was amazing. As a researcher, he was even more amazing. In the Oregonian obituary article, his colleague, Dr. Robert Steiner, called Bill humble and said, though he had many reasons for pride, Bill was a very humble man, that he was endlessly curious, energetic, and a gentle-mannered researcher at Oregon Health and Science University, where he practiced since 1975. Not only did he discover the rare artery clogging genetic disease in 1974, he also published nearly 400 research articles over his career, with more in the pipeline when he passed away. And many of you may have his and his wife Sonia Connor's cookbook on your above your kitchen sink. And he was at the cutting edge of doing research on how omega-3 fatty acids such as fish oil help prevent heart attacks. So his research on fish oil, he was not only involved in medicine, but encouraging the eating of salmon. You could say he was part of Oregon's economic development strategy as well, having people eat more Oregon salmon. I remember calling him one time thinking that I would get him at home, and I was probably calling him to engage in some, you know, to help me or to help a cause that I was involved in. And he said, Chip, I'm on the phone here, but I can't talk right now. I'm here with a patient with my son at the Free Clinic in Northeast Portland. And this was about 7:30 at night. So here is one of the most dedicated researchers, dedicated family man, and yet he still carved out time to see my constituents for free at the Free Clinic in my district, which was incredible. truly incredible. The last way I got to know Bill was through the activism, and he was one of the chief co-sponsors on a ballot measure to replace the death penalty with mandatory life imprisonment with no chance of parole. And so it was Bill Connor, Norma Paulus, and Senator Mark Hatfield who were the chief co-sponsors. And even in dealing with Senator Hatfield and Norma Paulus, he had a reverence and respect for both of them so much. And in the midst of trying to get enough signatures back in 2000 to get this on the ballot, you know, we had to move really quickly, and I was just saying, could you just call Senator Hatfield and ask him, you know, this question, and if he'll do this, this. He said, you know, sit down, my son. This is not how we operate here. I'm going to call on Senator Hatfield personally and ask him these three questions. I'm not just going to call him up on the phone. And that was just kind of a reverence and respect that he had for him that I thought was touching as to who he was as a person. So I could go on and on about Bill and all of the things that he did here as well as in Iowa where he grew up, but I think that I will let the record speak for itself, and I would just encourage you to pass this on to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and members of this committee. I come before you respectfully to support the resolution to honor Dr. Bill Connors. My name is Ron Steiner. I'm the board chairman of Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, and I speak today on behalf of the more than 2,000 members of our organization and the 60 to 70 organizations that support our efforts as well. Dr. Connors has been an inspiration to me personally and to our organization. While most of his testimony will cover things that are outstanding about his life and career as a gifted scientist, an accomplished researcher, a dedicated educator, and a caring and compassionate physician, I come to testify on two other aspects of this great man's life. A lifelong Quaker, Dr. Connors lived the core tenets of that faith, peace-seeking and social justice. It was always a bit strange to me that Iowa was one of the 17 states that had abolished the death penalty. Iowa's conservative politics and matter-of-fact demeanor points out that they're not necessarily the center of progressive social movements. Yet when that repeal took place way back in 1965, Dr. Connors was in the center of the effort advocating for alternatives that were in line with his core values and beliefs that made more sense from a public policy point of view. When Dr. Connors came to Oregon in 1975, in spite of a heavy load at OSHU, he quickly engaged and helped to create the organization that I represent today, OADP. I first met Dr. Connors in 2003, and I was immediately struck by his calm, reasoned approach to moving hearts and minds in the direction of peace and justice. Over the next 6 years, in frequent meetings, I observed him exhibit extraordinary leadership, share enormous wisdom, and encourage patience moving Oregon forward. He always advocated for alternatives that made sense from a criminal justice point of view and a policy of fiscal responsibility. Even as the deadly disease that eventually took his life made it difficult for him to get downtown to Portland to attend meetings, he would invite us to his home on Sherwood Place on the hill near the hospital to lead in a manner that was inspirational and admired. The twinkle in his eye never left him. The charming smile that was ever present graced his face, and wisdom flowed as he spoke. This is still imprinted on the memory I have of him. When the citizens of Oregon replaced the death penalty with better alternatives along the lines of peace and social justice, Dr. Bill Connors' fingerprints and image will be all over the effort. He was a great inspiration in his endeavors in the sciences and his efforts to promote a better Oregon. We continue to be motivated by his memory and his legacy. and I urge you to support and pass this resolution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm really pleased to be here to talk about Bill Connor. I knew him just about the time he came to Oregon. I've known him for about 40 years. At that time, I was working as a part of a national study, a national heart disease prevention study called the Multiple Risk Factor Intervention Trial. And it was a significant study with prevention researchers from around the country involved. We had screened 400,000 men, found about 13,000 at high risk of heart disease based on cigarette smoking, high cholesterol, or high blood pressure, and were involved in a 10-year intervention project with about 14,000 of them in a study group and a control group. 1975 was really early in the nutritional research area, particularly nutritional behavioral research. And while we had some of the great scientists in the country in this area involved in the study team, and also some of the great egos in the country involved in the study team, we really needed a ton of help. And we came to Bill to talk about how we would really work to help men with high cholesterol deal with their nutrition in a way to reduce their heart disease prevention. We eventually reduced heart disease death rates by about 25% over a 10-year period in our population. But Bill and Sonia were just extraordinary in their calm and peaceful and quiet way, helping us get a better handle on what was necessary to get these high-risk men in a healthier position. They knew more about the underlying science in this nutritional area than virtually anybody else related to the trial, and they also knew how to apply it. Their cookbook was not an accident, because their belief was if you were going to help people change, you had to give them the tools to help them change in a way that went along with the science that underlined the whole question of the problem of diet. They were, and he was just an extraordinary partner in this research, and I learned to admire him and to really honor his wisdom and his ability to work with people in a way that allowed them to help themselves better their lives. And honoring him with this resolution, I think, would be a very appropriate thing, and I would urge you all to take action on it when it comes time to move this bill into a work session.
Any questions? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, a comment. I, too, knew this gentleman. I came out here to be faculty at OHSU in 87, and in addition to the research that I was running, I was the associate director of the General Clinical Research Center and the director of the core lab for the General Clinical Research Center. And the lab processed many, many samples collected under studies run by Bill and Sonia and others. They were some of the main users of the GCRC at that time, late 80s. And I was a fairly cocky young scientist and a bench scientist without much exposure to clinical trials. And I was used to controlling all variables, or so we thought anyway. And we could control variables to a much greater extent in the bench situation than we could in the clinic. And so I was reviewing protocols submitted for the use of the GCRC, and there was this one that came in from Bill, and hypothesis seemed vague, ability of the studies to really comment and reflect on the hypothesis seemed tenuous, and I called up Bill, and I started going, dot, 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 dot. And when I stopped, it was just silence. And then Bill said, "Chris, we should try to get along. Let's have lunch." I said, "Ooh, okay." So I remember him as a mentor in and a very calm presence. And that was my initial contact with him face to face, and there were many, many other instances where that was borne out. So I will happily be a yes.
That was a part of your education.
Darn tootin'.
I have a question for the representative. Can I gavel out of the public hearing and open a work session?
No. We don't have authorization to do that yet.
Yeah, okay.
We need the fiscal.
Yeah, right.
Well, it will be an honor to do so at the right time.
You can do that if you'd like.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming.
Better you than me.
Oh, I can't. Okay.
Wow. Still taping. Chaos.
A couple more.
We are rudderless.
So what's going on? Yeah.
Go for it.
What are we doing?
Hey. Okay. Public hearing is closed.
All right.
And committee is adjourned.
Really? Mm-hmm.